This is an NPR News special. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. John McCain went to the White House today where he got lunch and the endorsement of President George W. Bush. No such finality on the Democratic side. The battle is still on. McCain's sweep of yesterday's four primaries gave him more than enough delegates to secure the Republican nomination, and Mike Huckabee dropped out. Hillary Clinton won three of the four but made up little ground in the Democratic delegate count, where Barack Obama still leads. But it's so close that no matter what happens from here on out, neither can realistically win the nomination on pledged delegates alone. The Democratic nomination will rest in the hands of the superdelegates. Over the course of this hour, we'll look back at what happened yesterday and ahead to what's next. We'll talk with representatives from the campaigns and talk with superdelegate and former Democratic vice presidential candidate Geraldine Ferraro. And it's your chance to weigh in. How did Texas, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Vermont change things? We want to hear from those of you who participated. If you voted, caucused, or worked the election, call and tell us what it was like. We have three phone lines for you today. Independents can call 800-989-8255. Again, Independents, 800-989-8255. The Republican line is 800-344-3893. Again, Republicans, 800-344-3893. The number for Democrats is 800-344-3864. Again, 800-344-3864 for Democrats. And everybody can send us email. That address is talk@npr.org. We begin with NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving here with us in Studio 3A. Hey, Ron.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And let's begin with the contest that finished yesterday. 6 months ago, John McCain was largely written off. He not only won, he won going away.
Yes, the asterisk has risen to be the star. You know, it's interesting because a year ago, John McCain was the presumptive front runner in the Republican Party. He had been the strongest candidate who didn't win in 2000. He had remained highly visible throughout the last 8 years. He had the loyalty of the military, the loyalty of a number of people who felt that they were speaking for the establishment of the Republican Party, put together an establishment inevitability campaign, and it collapsed within 3 or 4 months. They raised a lot of money, but they spent more than they raised. And everyone wrote him off saying, well, he tried. He failed, and let's go on to these other candidates. And there were a lot of them. It was a half a dozen or so. Some of them were very sexy and attractive, and you had Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani and Fred Thompson, the movie star and TV star. All those candidacies sequentially collapsed, except Mitt Romney's and the suddenly emergent Mike Huckabee. But in the end, neither one of them could stop John McCain, because after he had made his comeback and won the New Hampshire primary, everybody else started knocking each other off, and John McCain kept sailing to plurality after plurality.
Beginning today, though, Senator McCain faces a number of challenges. First, how does he compete for attention amid a red-hot race in the Democratic Party?
You know, in a way, you could argue that things continued to fall into place for this John McCain, who was reborn over the last 6 months. Now he's got two Democratic rivals who are about to commence, one would imagine, 6 or 7 weeks of horrendously negative campaigning. It's already gotten pretty nasty out there. It's bound to get worse because neither one of them really has any way to win this thing without tearing the other one down. We'll see. I don't want to predict and tell people that they can't run a positive campaign. And Barack Obama certainly has tried to run a positive campaign in the main. But we'll see where it goes in the next 6 or 7 weeks. It's got to get rougher.
And also, how does he transform that shoestring primary campaign operation into a national presidential campaign?
There's a real challenge there, in part because he still has to work out his relationship with the Federal Election Commission and the promises that he may or may not have made about taking public financing. That's for both the primary and for the fall. No question he has promised that if the Democrat will take public financing in the fall and limit spending, he will too. But in the primary, well, that's a bigger question mark. He's already spent more money than the limits of the FEC rules would allow him to if he's taking public financing. He's trying to get out of taking it now that he's back in the chips. But we'll see whether or not some of the commitments that he made for that money in terms of bank loans and so on catch him up and entangle him in the limits that the FEC puts on his spending.
The other big winner yesterday, unquestionably, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, who won three of the four races, including the two big ones, the must-win states of Texas and Ohio. And joining us now on the phone from here in Washington is Harold Ickes, senior campaign advisor to Senator Clinton. It's good to have you on the program today.
Hello.
Congratulations.
Hillary did well.
She did. Yet even with those victories, she still lags behind in the delegate count. It looks now as if neither she nor Senator Obama will be able to get to that magic number with pledged delegates alone. Is that your calculation, too?
I think that's one of the few things that both campaigns agree on, that neither candidate can reach the number to be nominated 2024 if Florida and Michigan are not taken into account, or the higher number. Both are going to need very substantial numbers of automatic delegates.
And that that raises a big question of how those superdelegates are going to break down. And so far, there are the superdelegates, of course, have pledged to both candidates at this point, but some have switched, and they're able to switch at any moment. How is this going to break down, do you think?
Well, the I call them automatic or super. The automatic delegates can switch, as can pledged delegates. There's no binding rule in our party. That was eliminated at the 1980 convention in a bitter fight on the floor. But so pledged delegates can move, super delegates or automatic delegates can move. We expect to see some modest changes back and forth. Both sides are talking to the automatic delegates of others, but Hillary Clinton is substantially ahead of Senator Obama on automatic delegates at this point.
And obviously there is another big state still out there. Pennsylvania is the biggest of them. It's a long time, though, between here and Pennsylvania.
It is. I just want to say that this distinction between pledged delegates and automatic delegates, in my view, is phony. I understand why the Obama campaign is saying this. You know, they have this rhetoric about the voice of the people. The fact is that nearly half of the automatic delegates are members of Congress. They are elected every 2 years. Many of them are elected in very tough general election races. They were added by the Hunt Commission in 1980 because if they had institutional interests. They do run every 2 years. They are very much in tune with the issues and the politics of their respective districts. In fact, I would dare say that a member of Congress who stands for election every 2 years, unlike a delegate, often who is standing for election for the first time in his or her life, or at most once every 4 years, a member of Congress, an automatic delegate, is much more in tune with what's going on.
Of course, other
does represent the voice of the people.
Of course, other automatic representatives or superdelegates are party officials and former party officials and former candidates and that sort of thing. Nevertheless, that rhetoric, as you say, from the Obama camp, it's convincing to a lot of Democrats, the idea that the candidate who got the most number of votes or the most number of pledged delegates ought to get the nomination.
No. But again, that's a phony distinction. When the chairman of the convention or the chairwoman of the convention calls the roll of the states for the vote on the nomination, they don't ask the delegation, the chair of the delegation. They call New York. What's your vote? And that the chair of that delegation will respond, Madam Chair or Mr. Chairman. New York votes, certain number of votes for Senator Clinton, certain number of votes for Senator Obama. Nobody asked whether that was the number of superdelegates or automatic delegates or pledged delegates or add-on delegates or PLEO delegates. I mean, this literally is a completely phony distinction. I understand that why they're doing it to serve their political interests, but it has no meaning there's no political reality to it.
The other question that a lot of people are asking is about the tenor of the campaign in the last few weeks, and it seemed to be effective, particularly Senator Clinton challenging Senator Obama on national security, the 3 o'clock in the morning phone call ad, that sort of thing, which a lot of people see as a negative attack. Is that going to be continuing, do you think?
Well, we think that these are legitimate questions to raise. I mean, we are nominating somebody who we hope as a party will become the president of the United States for the next 4 and hopefully 8 years. It's the most powerful position in the world, and there are a lot of challenges that have to be met, and we think that these are legitimate areas of inquiry. How experience for the job is certainly a critical feature that we think that should be taken into account before we make our final decision on who the nominee will be.
And if you had to point to one factor that made the difference for you in three states yesterday, what would that be, do you think?
Well, I think that people really have made a judgment in these three states, as they have in many other states, New York and California and Arizona, New Mexico, Missouri, and others, that I think the judgment is being arrived at that as we look at who will be the strongest, one who will be the most prepared to be president will be Hillary Clinton, based on her experience and other factors. Two, another important consideration will be who will be able to best stand up against the Republican attack machine that will turn full fire on whoever our nominee is. And then thirdly, and very importantly, who can appeal to the key constituencies in the so-called swing or purple states, such as Ohio, New Mexico, Nevada, Arkansas, Florida, to mention only a few, that will be needed to assemble 270 electoral votes in the general election. It's not enough to win California, New York, and the traditional blue states. You've got to win enough of those swing states to make 270.
Let's get a caller in on this conversation. And Mary is with us on the Democratic line from Salt Lake City in Utah.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to ask whether your experts believe that the fact that Bill Clinton has decidedly been not on the news, had nothing to say about anything, has a lot to do with Hillary's resurgence.
Harold Ickes, what do you think? I'm afraid we just have a few seconds for this.
Yeah, I didn't quite get the...
The question, President Clinton has been notably absent, Mary says, in recent days. Did that have an effect, do you think?
No, he's been campaigning. You know, I don't know. He's been fully campaigning in Texas, in Ohio, Rhode Island. He's been all over those states. He's been fully engaged in the campaign.
Harold Ickes, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
Harold Ickes, a senior spokesman for Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign, joined us on the phone from here in Washington, D.C. When we return, we'll be speaking with a representative from the Obama campaign. We'll also be talking about the race in the Republican Party, which is over, and how John McCain looks forward from here and which Democrat he might prefer to run against. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. This is an NPR News special. This is an NPR News special. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, voting in Texas, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Vermont clinched the Republican presidential nomination for Senator John McCain. The Democrat he'll run against remains unclear. Even after Senator Hillary Clinton gained some much-needed ground, it's clear that neither candidate can win the nomination on pledged delegates alone. And in a minute, we'll be talking with Senator Barack Obama's campaign manager about the way forward in his campaign. We're going over all the results with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving and taking your calls. We're using separate phone lines today. If you're a Republican, 800-344-3893. Democrats, 800-344-3864. And that's for independents, 800-989-8255. And joining us now, as we mentioned, is David Plouffe, the campaign manager for Barack Obama. He's on the line with us from Chicago. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
And were you realistically hoping for a knockout yesterday?
Well, we started just a couple of weeks ago with 20-point deficits in both Texas and Ohio. And so we were simply trying to make up as much ground as we could. And, you know, we view this as a race for delegates. And we've still got quite a bit of vote to still be counted, and the Texas caucus results are still outstanding. But, you know, it looks like Senator Clinton's gain may be in the range of 4 to 10, a very minimal gain, less than we netted out of the one state of Idaho on February 5th. So, you know, from a delegate perspective, we actually see this as a missed opportunity for the Clinton campaign because there were 370 delegates at stake yesterday. They themselves said they needed to make huge gains yesterday from a delegate perspective, and they were not able to attain that.
By our count, there's no realistic way that she could catch up to the Obama count in terms of pledged delegates, but there's also no realistic way that either Senator Obama or Senator Clinton get the number of pledged delegates required to win the nomination on the first ballot. So this is one way or another going to be in the hands of the superdelegates.
Well, yeah, our belief has been that the pledged delegate leader at the end of this process will be the Democratic nominee. You've seen a lot of superdelegates themselves express great unease about a situation where they would go counter to the results of these primaries and caucuses. So, you know, it's clear the Clinton campaign is going to run a scorched earth campaign and try and somehow suggest to the superdelegates that she would be a stronger nominee. You know, the truth is Senator Clinton would be a deeply flawed Democratic nominee. She has very little appeal to independent voters. you know, in matchups in battleground states with John McCain, Senator Obama consistently does better because of his strength with independent voters. And, you know, Senator Clinton, I think, is someone also that would hurt down-ballot Democrats in many states. So I think that we believe that we are going to both have the pledged delegates, but also decisive will be the stronger candidate against Senator McCain.
And what do you foresee in the coming weeks? Is the some people in the Democratic Party fear a Donnybrook between the two big candidates, and that will only go to the benefit of the Republican candidate, John McCain?
Well, we're just going to focus on competing in every state. You know, the Clinton campaign likes to pick out states and say, well, it's only about the big states, or, you know, it's generally only about the states they win. But, you know, we've got Wyoming coming up, Mississippi coming up, we've got Pennsylvania, we've got Indiana, North Carolina. So we're just going to keep focus on accumulating as many delegates as we can, doing as well as we can in each state. And, you know, it's clear the Clinton campaign is going to run a scorched earth negative campaign. Everything else they tried did not work. And so we're going to remain focused on our positive message. We're obviously going to defend ourselves. And there are big differences in this race. So I do think that, you know, Senator Clinton likes to talk about that we have not been vetted. The truth is neither has she in this race. You know, she still refuses to release her tax returns. There's a lot of questions around donors to the library. And so I think that for voters who are worried about things that may come out here, you know, Senator Clinton has much more exposure than we do.
Yet, you mentioned that she would be a flawed candidate, yet she points out she's won in a number of big, important states. Ohio, most recently, and very importantly, Ohio is a crucial state for any Democrat who hopes to win in the general election.
Well, so we've won a lot more battleground states than she has. Wisconsin, Missouri, Iowa, Minnesota, Colorado, Washington State, Virginia. So we've won big battleground states. And, you know, Senator Clinton won Ohio. The truth is we're going to get just about every vote that was cast for her last night in the general election. What Senator Clinton is not able to do against John McCain is receive the votes of enough independents to win and or moderate Republicans. So what it creates is a no margin for error election with Senator Clinton. And we've seen that movie too many times.
Thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks. Have a good afternoon.
David Plouffe, the campaign manager for Barack Obama, joining us on the phone from Chicago. Still with me is NPR Washington editor, senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, here in Studio 3A. And Ron, as you listen to those two campaign spokesmen, both clearly spinning their stories, nevertheless, both have strong arguments.
Yes, there's some truth in what each of them said. There are also some things that might invite a certain amount of comment that each of them said. I do think it is extraordinary, and I think it is a hard thing for most listeners, most readers to understand that there were 370 delegates at stake on the Democratic side yesterday. And in the end, although Hillary won 3 out of 4 and won the two biggies in the primary, Ohio and Texas, it would appear right now that the likeliest delegate split is 190 for her and 180 for Obama. That is a difference of 10. Mm-hmm. 10 out of 370. So it may not be right. It may not be the best rule system in the world, but those are the numbers. And so as we come away from this apparently smashing turnaround night for Hillary Clinton, and certainly no one can take it away from her that she's won these two states that are among the 10 most populous, she has not made a dent, an appreciable dent, and it may not even be as large as 10, in his delegate lead.
And that one factor that is still outstanding, though, is what happens with Florida and Michigan. Harold Ickes mentioned it earlier. There were primaries in those states by party rule because they moved them too early in the process. Those delegates do not count. Yet are two big states, Florida and Michigan, not going to have delegates at the Democratic National Convention?
I think there's no chance that they will not have delegates. They will have delegates. They'll be seated. They'll get to wear all the funny hats. They'll get to go to all the silly parties. But will they be allowed, Michigan and Florida, to individually, those two states, determine the nominee of the Democratic Party as their reward for having broken all the rules? I don't think so. Either they're going to have do-overs, and suddenly we're hearing from the Clinton campaign for the first time, from Terry McAuliffe, that maybe that would be all right. Maybe we could have Florida and Michigan just go back and vote again and go on the basis of those numbers. Obviously, they're feeling better about their momentum mm-hmm. now and think that might be a good idea. Whether the states will do it is another question. They could also seat the delegations and just tell them, your votes are going to have to reflect the votes of the rest of the country. You're not going to be allowed to tip this one way or another by virtue of having gone outside the rules. So you can come, you can sit, you can be part of all this, but you will have to split your vote to reflect the pledged delegate count from the rest of the country.
Senator John McCain had lunch with President Bush today and then went out into the Rose Garden of the White House to accept the president's endorsement on a warm, sunny day here in Washington, D.C.
I have got to know John well in the last 8 years. I've campaigned against him, and I've campaigned with him. Laura and I have spent time in their house. It's a man who deeply loves his family. It's a man who cares a lot about the less fortunate among us. He's a president, and he's going to be the president, who will bring determination to defeat an enemy and a heart big enough to love those who hurt. And so I welcome you here. I wish you all the best. I'm proud to be your friend.
President George W. Bush giving his support today to Senator John McCain in the White House Rose Garden. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Republican strategist Scott Reed, who ran Bob Dole's presidential campaign in 1996, is a former head of the Republican National Committee as well. Good to have you with us.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
And what does Senator McCain's challenge now, part of it is to woo conservatives who have been skeptical of his campaign all along. Does he still have that problem?
Well, McCain's big challenge now is to unite the Republican Party, the conservatives, the moderates, the liberals, the entire party. And this event today with President Bush was a big step in that direction. This is kind of the capper for McCain. He now is the leader of the Republican Party as he goes in as the nominee. And he has a real opportunity here because as he uses his time to unite the party, he begins to raise money. Most importantly, he's able to begin to set the terms of the debate with the Democrats. And obviously they're going to be in a bit of a fight here that's going to go on for a while, as you've been discussing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good opportunity for McCain to put his house in order, start raising the money, talk about the issues of national security and economic growth that he cares about, he'll be campaigning on. And those are also sharp contrasts with either Obama or Clinton, whoever wins on the other side.
How does the endorsement of President Bush help with independence?
Well, it helps with Republicans. It helps put the final touch on Republicans. And now McCain's going to be in a position where he can pivot to independents. But uniting the party is important. Having the base of your party behind you, having 90, 92% of that support when you go into the general election is very important. And Bush, as the commander-in-chief, it's important to have had this endorsement.
And already, well, for weeks now, speculation has been going on about a vice presidential candidate who will be very important to John McCain.
It will be an important decision, as it always is for every nominee, but especially important because it's really the first time the American people will see how McCain goes through a decision-making process. How does he make a decision as big as this? And it doesn't need to start. It probably won't start for another 45 or 60 days. They'll begin talking about it, but he has all summer to do that. I would not be surprised to see McCain pick someone before the convention. This is not just going to be a traditional campaign run by McCain. He's going to mix it up a little, and I think you're going to see him have someone out there mid to late summer to be part of a team as they draw that contrast with the Democrats.
Let's see if we can get a caller in, and this is Mike. Mike calling on the independent line from Milwaukee.
Oh, hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
I'd like to ask your guest, to what extent can Senator Clinton thank conservative talk radio's endorsement of her, you know, telling them to go out and vote for her, for her victory in the primaries last night?
In Texas in particular, I think that question would be, Rush Limbaugh was among those agitating for Republicans to go and vote for Senator Clinton yesterday. Do you think that played much of a role?
I think it played some role, but I really think what the turning point here was for Clinton was about 2 weeks ago when Saturday Night Live had that first skit about the race and how the press, it appeared they were giving Obama a free ride. And since then, you saw both the press get a little tougher on Obama. You saw Clinton get a little tougher on Obama, put out a very rough ad at the end of last week. And I think that turning point, you look at who voted for Clinton. A lot of people made up their mind in those last 3 days. She won that support hands down. And I think what you're seeing is the press playing a little catch-up ball with Obama now. Clearly, they have been giving him a little bit of a free ride, and it's now getting a little warmer for him.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Mike. But speaking of Rush Limbaugh and other conservative radio talk show hosts, they have been staunchly against John McCain. Do you think he can bring them around to his side? And if not, will that play a difference?
I think McCain's big speech a few weeks ago at the conservative event here in Washington was the first step in the right direction. I don't think he's ever going to totally satisfy Rush. But the truth is, if McCain gets out there and talks about conservative ideas that he's run on and believes in and is talking about governing with, I think you're going to see conservatives. But look, nothing unites the Republicans and the conservatives better than a Clinton. And clearly that's what Rush has been up to, and it probably caused a little mischief down there in Texas yesterday.
And that strongly suggests that you agree with the conventional wisdom that Republicans would much rather face Senator Clinton than Senator Obama.
Well, one thing Republicans have learned, you don't try to pick who your opponent is. But the fact is, Hillary Clinton is a very polarizing figure in politics today. About half the electorate likes her and half doesn't like her. And going into an election, we believe on the surface that would be a positive.
That's Scott Reed, the campaign manager for Bob Dole back in 1996 and a former executive director of the Republican National Committee. You're listening to an NPR News special. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Steve, from San Antonio on the Republican line.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I just want to make the point, I am 23 years old. I attended my first caucus last night. Very, very small Republican caucus, about maybe 7 or 8 people. And I noticed a really big disconnect. There's a huge disconnect between older people in the Republican Party and the younger people that have come in this election year that have basically, you know, are trying to infuse the Republican Party with new energy. You know, first of all, as far as John McCain goes, I can't see how he has secured the nomination while the majority of conservatives in this country really dislike him. I mean, you know, I haven't met anybody, any kind of real conservative, that is interested in McCain at all. You see this big disconnect there, though, because, you know, the older people are usually going to be the war hawks, the people who are for the war in Iraq, and, you know, on and on like that. But the younger people, which, you know, you can guess which one, you know, which candidate I supported, Ron Paul. The Ron Paul supporters are being marginalized and ignored, you know, in this movement. And so you see a huge disconnect there where younger people that are trying to get into the Republican Party, they're trying to you know, and the funny thing is it resembles the old right. If you look back at Senator Taft, older Republicans who really believed in the party platform, this youth movement within the Republican Party resembles that.
Well, Steve, see if we get a response from Scott Reed.
I think some of the, Steve, it's a good question and a good point, and I applaud you for going to the caucus last night. But I think some of the polling I've seen has shown that younger Republicans are attracted to McCain. He talks about issues that they care about. He talks about issues like the environment. He's the one Republican that's probably furthest out on doing something about greenhouse gases and other things like that. He's also has this independent streak, which I think a lot of younger voters will like as you get into the fall campaign.
And Steve, let me ask you another question. You said you've not met any what you called real conservatives who have anything nice to say about John McCain. Compared to what? Compared to other candidates in the Republican Party, that may be. But as you now face the possibility, it's either going to be John McCain or Senator Clinton or Senator Obama.
Well, yes, and I think that's absolutely unfortunate, though. I mean, I don't think people were exactly voting with their heads when they voted for McCain. If McCain's a Republican, then I'm Garrison Keillor.
Well,
I mean, you know.
Welcome to Lake Wobegon. Thanks very much for the call, Steve.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Steve suggests that there are some difficulties with the Republican base, and I think Senator McCain would certainly readily admit that, but he does have time, as you say, to put that organization together, time to create a new national organization out of the rather sort of bootstrap primary campaign operation he was going on. Nevertheless, Democrats may be sniping at each other for the next several weeks or months even, but it's going to be hard for John McCain to get a lot of attention.
Well, not really. I mean, McCain's going to have an opportunity here to spend some time and rebuild the party, as you pointed out, and begin to raise some of the funds. But most importantly, he's now the Republican. He will have the platform. He can go out and give a major policy address every week, every 10 days. It will be covered by the media, and it will really allow him to put out his new brand of the Republican Party. And that's what this is about. This is not a Bush party anymore. This is now going to be the McCain party. And it's important that he goes out and rebrands it and looks to the future. And we don't spend a lot of time talking about the past.
And is it important for him to very quickly to distinguish himself from George W. Bush?
It's very important for him to talk about what a McCain presidency would look like in the future. and not waste time talking about the past.
Scott Reed, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Scott Reed, Republican strategist, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. Stay with us. When we come back, more of your calls. We'll also be talking with a Democratic superdelegate and former vice presidential nominee, Geraldine Ferraro, will join us to talk about the role that superdelegates will play in the Democratic process as it goes on from here. Again, yesterday, John McCain won the Republican presidential nomination. He now has enough pledged delegates to win on the first ballot. It now looks as if neither Senator Obama nor Senator Clinton can win enough pledged delegates to do that in the Democratic Party. Superdelegates will make the decision. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. This is an NPR News special. This is an NPR News special. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are headlines from the other stories we're following here today at NPR News. The Senate Armed Services Committee is hearing testimony today on last week's decision by the Air Force to purchase French-made Airbus refueling aircraft. Some members of Congress say the decision hurts job production in the United States. And the Vatican and a delegation of Muslim scholars have agreed to improve their dialogue, though a permanent channel through a permanent channel of communication. An unprecedented Catholic-Muslim forum will meet in November with the participation of Pope Benedict XVI. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered. The Republicans have their man, Senator John McCain. The Democrats remain without a nominee thus far, and no realistic way for either Senator Obama or Senator Clinton to win enough pledged delegates to win on the first ballot. That leaves superdelegates in a major decision-making role. They don't have to follow the voters. We'll talk with Superdelegate Geraldine Ferraro in just a minute, and, of course, we want to hear from you. What do you think about the role of superdelegates? We're using split phone lines today. Republicans can call at 800-344-3893 for Democrats, 800-344-3864. Email goes to our regular address, talk@npr.org. The independent line is 800-989-8255. Still with us here in Studio 3A is NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Ron, always good to have you on the program. And I wanted to ask you, as you look ahead to the, we were talking just a minute ago with Scott Reed, a Republican strategist, and this idea of rebuilding the Republican Party and trying to reassemble that coalition in a time-consuming process, doesn't that leave open the possibilities of complacency?
There could be a period of time during which Republicans rather forget that they have a stake in this thing, because there's going to be so much fascination with the Obama versus Hillary Clinton fight. I suspect that's going to be quite consuming for the media over the next 6-7 weeks. And it's going to be, yes, we're going to dutifully cover the speeches that John McCain makes that Scott Reed mentioned. And I do think we'll go and we'll listen and we'll take those seriously and we'll kind of pick them apart and we'll do whatever we would have done under normal circumstances.
Speculate as to who his vice president might be.
That kind of thing. Whether or not that draws as much attention from the audience in general is open to question. Generally speaking, that kind of stuff is a little wonky. It's a little down in the weeds for most people, and they're probably not going to pay as much attention to that as they will be to the horse race over on the other side. So there'll be less attention paid. Mm. And also, there's another thing I think that's going on here, and that is that John McCain is trying to figure out some way to separate himself from the Bush administration, even while he desperately needs its embrace. So today he goes to the White House, he has lunch, he gets his endorsement, but immediately then he's going to go out and say, I'm not George Bush, in every way that he possibly can. And when you hear Republicans saying, let's not talk about the past, that's the past, let's let the past go, let's go forward. What they're trying to say is, let's not think about the economy right now or what's going on in Iraq or what may have gone on with respect to the price of oil or what may have gone on with respect to the environment in recent years. Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about the contrast between John McCain and whichever of these two Democrats gets nominated.
Another trend that has been consistent throughout the primary season, and it didn't begin all that much long ago, but nevertheless, it seems like forever since the beginning of January. Nevertheless, many more Democrats turning out to vote in primary elections than Republicans, a trend which continued again last night.
Here's a stunning statistic, and I think it says a lot about the way John McCain has won this nomination. In South Carolina this year, John McCain received 150,000 fewer votes in South Carolina among Republicans than he did when he ran in 2000 and lost in South Carolina. So why did he win? Because there were lots more candidates. In 2000, he was just running against George W. Bush, and he lost badly. In 2008, he's running against four or five people, several of whom divided the vote that George W. Bush got in 2000, and John McCain won in a plurality. But it was a plurality of a smaller overall turnout, because the truth was South Carolina's Republicans did not care for any of the candidates on the ballot this time as much as they did in 2000 or, say, 1980, 1984.
Let's go back to the Democratic side. Joining us now from her office in New York is former Democratic vice presidential candidate Geraldine Ferraro. She's a superdelegate and a supporter of Hillary Clinton. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil, but I'm not a superdelegate. I don't fit within the category. I'm not an incumbent member of Congress. I'm not a current office holder, and I'm not a member of the DNC. I'm just a lawyer with Blank Rome, which is a national law firm, and obviously somebody who's been involved in the Clinton campaign, not as part of the campaign, but as someone who is a volunteer willing to help her raise money and do whatever I can to see that she becomes the nominee of the Democratic Party and wins in November.
Well, then, as a party elder, then,
I'll take that.
Okay. Let me ask you about the role of superdelegates. There are large numbers of them in the Democratic Party. It now looks as if, by our calculations, neither Senator Clinton nor Senator Obama can get the number of pledged delegates. They need to put them over that magic number. At this point, the decision is going to be in the hands of the superdelegates.
It could be. That was, by the way, a class of delegates that I was instrumental in creating in 1982, when chairman of the DNC, Chuck Manatt, appointed the Hunt Commission, which was run by Governor Jim Hunt of North Carolina, to look into the rules of the party and to address the issues that created the fact that we were in total disarray in 1980 and ended up losing with that election, not only President Carter's reelection to the White House, but also the Democratic majority in the Senate. It became Republican, and we lost a lot of seats in the House. So, you know, if you take a look at what the condition of our party was at the time, we decided, or the elders at that time, I was really much younger then, decided to put together a commission to look at all the things that what we could do to bring our party together. And one of the things was create this super delegate status. And we did that because in 1980, and for very many other campaigns, in order to get to the convention, a delegate had to be elected generally by their own district. Mm-hmm. What had happened was many members of Congress wouldn't run against their own constituents. It was not a politically good thing to do. But in addition to that, if they didn't run, they weren't delegates, they didn't participate in writing the platform, they didn't do any of that stuff. And if you go back again to what happened in 1980 when Jimmy Carter was challenged by
Senator Kennedy,
we ended up with floor fights, 23 amendments. Now, that is not going to happen at this convention, no matter what. I mean, these people are right in tune. There's very little, I mean, in some instances it's significant, unlike on health care, but very little difference between their positions on health care and very many other things. Significant difference, obviously, with John McCain. So we're not going to have the fights in the platform, and we didn't have those fights in E4, but we created these people so that they would be given the opportunity to participate without having to run. And that participation, we wanted them to lead. We wanted them to look at the Credentials Committee and be part of it. We wanted them to help write the platform so that they wouldn't run away from it. And what ended up happening was it kind of worked. We lost anyway in 1984, but it had nothing to do with internal politics. In this election, when I said, they're going to have a tough time getting to 225. I don't see how either one of them does it before the convention. But, you know, we do have other states. We do have superdelegates at large. And now I got to tell you, we have more superdelegates than when they were originally created. We didn't put all these DNC people on there, so that now they're over 700. There were like maybe 300 that we created at the time.
But the situation that has been created is illustrated by this email that we got from Audrey in Lyle, Washington. If Obama has the plurality of votes and or electoral votes, and if the superdelegates give the election to Senator Clinton, the Democratic Party will likely return to its apathetic past. The last two elections told us that votes don't mean that much. This will only confirm that suspicion. Farewell to voter participation and pride in our democratic system.
Well, you know, those are people who are looking at the enthusiasm that has been generated not only by Barack Obama's campaign, but also by Hillary Clinton's. You know, I heard Tim Russert say, if the South Carolina, Senator Obama's people are going to be very disappointed if he doesn't get the nomination. Well, folks, so are Senator Clinton's people going to be very disappointed. I mean, that's not the issue. The issue that has to come before the convention is, first of all, you know, and I before I got to superdelegates, I would look very carefully. I would have, if I were an attorney representing those two states, I'd say you go before the Credentials Committee, Florida and Michigan, and let them see if they will admit you. Because, you know, one, Florida has a very good case. Michigan doesn't. I would have a real tough time with Michigan. Michigan, you know, thwarted the rules of the DNC. But Florida didn't. Florida's date, you know, the rule that you can't have it before a certain date because they were protecting Iowa and New Hampshire. In Florida, the date was set by a Republican governor and a Republican legislature.
The Democratic Party makes its own rules.
But the Democrat, yeah. And so technically, Governor Crist violated the rules of the DNC. Governor Crist was under no obligations to adhere to the rules of the DNC because he's a Republican and he was doing what was best for the Republican Party.
But
you'll
getting
recall,
back to the
that was when Giuliani was going to be in there, and so that brought a lot of money and a lot of attention to his state. He was doing what was right for him and for his party, and you notice that he also endorsed John McCain right before that. So it was done on a political basis for what was better for Republicans. How can Democrats, 1.5 million people who went out to the polls to vote, and by the way, in that state, neither one of them campaigned, neither one of them raised money, neither one of them did anything at all to influence that election. It was the voters who made the decision. Can you say that?
That's open to interpretation and to argument, in fact. But getting back to the original question.
Tell me what the argument is.
Well, the argument is that Senator Clinton, for example, had a victory party the night of the primary. Not campaigning during the primary, but a lot of attention paid. And did raise money.
She campaigned. And I live down there part-time.
But why do you get back to the original question? If Senator Obama, for example, just hypothetically, has the largest number of pledged delegates and won the largest number of votes in the primaries, shouldn't he win the support of the majority of the superdelegates?
No, and the issue is this. I have to tell you that if I were looking at the rules, at one point there were rules passed that only Democrats could vote in primaries. That's in New York State. We're very smart here. If you want to be the nominee of our party, you go to Democrats. You don't go to Republicans and have them figure out maybe who is going to be the weakest person to run against their nominee or have them shove over. And who are the Republicans to make a determination on what we are doing? I have to tell you, I look at these numbers in Texas. It was Hillary did well, but I got to tell you, she would have done a lot better if Republicans had stayed out of this whole thing. I was listening to Rush Limbaugh. I'm sure your NPR listeners are not people who listen to Rush Limbaugh, but I was listening to him when I was in Florida on my way up to the hospital. And there was a guy from Florida saying, I'm going to vote for Barack Obama in Texas. He was from Texas. And he said, I'm voting for him because if she gets the nomination and if she ever gets elected, she is going to get things done, which is terrible. I hate all of her policy. It's amazing that Republicans are allowed to vote. So who do those people reflect? Number one, those numbers, the elected delegates, do reflect the views of some Democrats, but they also reflect the views of Republicans and independents. And to be quite frank, to give those people a say in who our nominee is, it's okay to let them do it at this point, but don't tell me that they're going to make the decision on who is the final person, who is the best for the party, who can make the decision, who is best for the country. That's number one. But the other piece of it is that, you know, those superdelegates were put in there so that they could lead, not follow. I'm watching these superdelegates say that they're moving over. Now, I love John Lewis. I've known him a long time. He admitted it. He said, this is harder than when I marched in Selma. Well, you know why? Because in Selma, he did what he believed was right for his country. He got beaten up. He was just devastated. This thing, this man, this very strong man, has to be devastated because his was a political decision. Somebody filed a primary against him. There was a woman on today from the mayor of Dayton who said, you know, I was undecided, but, you know, two counties in my city went for Barack Obama, so I'm going with Barack Obama. That's not what this is all about. This is not a certification of who has already voted in the primaries. And by the way,
If it was, Senators Kennedy and Kerry would vote for Senator Clinton because she won the state of Massachusetts.
Not only Kennedy and Kerry because they're white, but also Governor Patrick, who is co-chair of Obama's campaign, because Massachusetts, he ran on the exact same type of platform, the exact same type of campaign a year ago, and they repudiated him, Kennedy, and Kerry. And last night in Rhode Island, by a 58% to 42%, Patrick Kennedy, who represents half of Rhode Island, who's an Obama supporter. I mean, what is it, only on one side that we're talking about that they should move over and support the candidate? Not good enough. Not good enough. I don't think any of them should move. I think Kerry should stay where he is. I think Kennedy should stay with. I think Patrick should stay, and I think the other delegates should too.
Geraldine
Ferraro.
The
only reason the other ones are moving is because they're worried about primaries.
Geraldine Ferraro, thanks very much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Geraldine Ferraro supports Hillary Clinton, and she's the former Democratic vice presidential candidate with us today from her office in New York. You're listening to an NPR News special. I'm Neil Conan, also with me, NPR senior editor Ron Elving, and let's see if we can squeeze a couple of calls in before our time runs out, and let's go to the Democratic line, and this is going to be Margarita. Margarita with us from Providence, Rhode Island.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment because I believe that Geraldine Ferraro was making the same points that Harold Dickey's made earlier in this session, where he basically said that voters, the unelected, are uninformed and really not worthy to make the final decisions about who our nominee should be. I just thought that was outrageous and arrogant, and it reflected what the Senator Clinton's campaign has become as this has gone along, that, you know, it's don't worry your pretty little head, we know best.
So this is not an argument, even though Senator Clinton clearly won in Rhode Island yesterday?
Yeah, well... You know, in Rhode Island, speaking personally, I feel like, you know, she's been very much tied into the very, very vested interests in the state, and that was what was refreshing about Senator Obama, which is that he included all of us who don't agree with where the state is heading otherwise.
Yes, but nevertheless, the majority of Democrats who voted yesterday voted for Senator Clinton.
This is true, but I have to say, when I went to vote, somehow I was listed as being in a Republican primary, and I basically had to cast a provisional ballot because somewhere along the line, my name had gotten listed in the wrong party, and I heard this morning from other people that were saying that the same thing had happened to them.
Margarita, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate
the
phone call. And Ron Elving, next, well, the people are looking ahead to Pennsylvania. That comes when?
April 22nd, which is 7 weeks from yesterday. That's a long time. That's almost as much time as there has been since the New Hampshire primary back at the first Tuesday of January. So, in a sense, all that we've been through the last 2 months, we're about to go through it all again.
And we're going to hear much more detailed arguments about Michigan and Florida and how they come in, and continued arguments about the role of superdelegates and should they go with their district, their state, or with their conscience.
Or are they normal delegates? Are they just the same as pledged delegates? Or is there some reason someone decided to call them super?
Ron Elving, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Stay tuned to NPR News for more details. And, well, we're still waiting for the Texas caucuses to be decided and the allocation of delegates there. So there is more information yet to come about yesterday's nominating contests. At npr.org/elections, you can hear from voters in Ohio, Texas, Rhode Island, and Vermont about what they had on their minds as they cast their ballots yesterday. We should mention we did contact the McCain campaign for an interview today. They were unable to provide a representative for this broadcast. Thanks for being with us. I'm Neil Conan. You've been listening to a special coverage from NPR News in Washington.